This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have BFM's very own Rahma Pauzi.
Hi.
Great to have you back. And we have the return of the woman who did the recent Georgetown Literary Festival. Author, poet, photographer, filmmaker. She's done everything. Bernice Shawley.
Hello.
And our three topics this week are, topic number one is the notion of happiness. Topic number two, gothic. And finally, topic number three is geology and culture. And so, topic number one, Rahma, the notion of happiness.
Yeah, I'm just trying to be a bit random today. But I mean, like, honestly, whatever that I'm about to talk about today has something to do with, like, whatever that I've experienced over the past few months, few weeks, you know, stress, bottling up, things like that. But whenever we talk about happiness, right, there's, like, one time when I was thinking about, oh, why can't I be happy? Like, this is so stressful. I'm sad. And I just want to be happy all the time. But that doesn't exist. And I was watching this video. And I watched this video. Someone forwarded this video a couple of years ago, actually, like 2 years ago. It was a talk on Al Jazeera. It was an interview with Zygmunt Bauman. He's a Polish sociologist, and he's passed away. About notion of happiness, this is what he said. A German poet, Wolfgang Goethe, was asked once, "Did you have a happy life?" And then he said, "I did have a happy life, but I cannot recall having one single happy week." And this is what he was trying to say, that the world of commerce, advertising, social media, marketing felt like you have to be happy every day. And thinking that happiness is a long phase of uninterrupted happiness. And that's what happiness is about. But happiness doesn't work like that. Happiness is always something that stems out of sadness, something that stems out of anger. The moment you overcome something, the moment you overcome a struggle, the moment you overcome sadness, the moment you overcome a disappointment, that's happiness. Like, the moment you accomplish something, that's happiness. The only way for you to be happy is to accomplish something. And I thought that's really lovely. Looking at social media, looking at people always posting good things, things that make them feel good, this whole notion of, like, you need to surround yourself with positivity and all that. Well, that's great, but life and world do not work like that.
Yeah, and it makes me feel miserable to see their constant happiness.
Yes, exactly, because it doesn't work like that. Life doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
So for you, what does happiness look like?
It used to be that, oh, I'm happy to be surrounded with, like, nice people. I'm happy. But no, like, I think it's something that you have to look forward to every time you're sad. It's something that you have to look forward to in life, because life is all about finding happiness. Life is all about overcoming struggle. Life is all about overcoming boundaries, right? And I think it should make you feel good thinking about happiness in this way, because it shows that you have to work for it. You know, like, the whole thing about, oh, simple things make you happy. Yes, sure, it does make you happy. But the real happiness is something that you work for.
Okay.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, because, I've been through, you know, various bouts of happiness and unhappiness in my life. And this came to me a few years ago when I was in the throes of despair. I think it was like, happiness is a choice. You make a choice to be happy. You wake up in the morning and you tell yourself, I'm going to be happy. But then again, as an artist, if I was happy all the time, I'd find it really boring.
Well, yeah, no, I mean,
you can't write poetry when you're happy.
I see where you're coming from. But that may be just a cliche as well. I'm not so sure if happiness is the choice. I think happiness is also brain chemistry. We are all born differently. And indeed, our diets and lifestyles can also have an impact on this. And no, seriously, happiness is about being able to function. I mean, you can be miserable and you function.
Yes.
But if you are miserable and you are now no longer functioning, then that becomes a spiral downwards. So things like Prozac and the like are very good at cutting out the low end of despair, but also kind of like nullifying the high end too.
Right, right.
But just so that you can function well enough get your life together to be able to do the things so that you can then operate in a landscape where it's not necessarily you're jumping up and down, you're happy, 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 but at least you're not going to, like, stab yourself in the head.
Yeah, I agree with you. But at the same time, I think what I'm trying to suggest here is happiness is being able to function. Yes, mm-hmm. that's right. But beyond functioning, happiness is about like being able to like get a purpose, knowing why you're here. You know, like thinking about it in Maslow hierarchy of needs, like the self-actualization is happiness. Like you eating something, that's happiness. But you getting there, like you getting the right kind of happiness when you know, like so jealous of people, when you like, why am I not there yet? It is a constant struggle. It's constant you pushing yourself to get there. So I agree with you, but I'm also like debating about the higher notion of happiness right now. So a lot of people would say that, oh, I'm like really sad and when is this going to be over? It's helpful to think about happiness in this way.
Sure.
Yeah, you know?
Yeah. If you accept that happiness is a moment in your life that you enjoy and that is something you want to pursue, then you must also accept that sadness is the 50% the other half of the side of the coin.
Yeah, you can only get the majestic, you know, of life the moment you accept the cruelties of life.
Yeah.
It can only happen that way.
Mm. Yeah, I think you learn to, you know, accept a lot more things when you get older and life takes on a different pace and you're just grateful for what you have, really. That your knees still work? That you...
yeah, absolutely.
I mean, you still have teeth?
Yeah.
Well, yesterday I ate an almond croissant. It was delicious.
That was nice.
Yeah, and my whole day was actually aimed toward that moment when I was going to eat an almond croissant. And otherwise, you know, outside of that, I mean, I'm numb to everything. So...
yeah, so the takeaway is the moment you feel like you deserve happiness as, or like look at happiness as like an interrupted flow of happiness, it doesn't work like that because that's not real.
Yeah.
That's just something that I want to put
out. But there is also brain chemistry. I mean, seriously,
yes.
If you can't get out of bed, that's a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you are entitled to that. And you mustn't feel bad about that. But there are ways, there are people you can talk to. There are things you can do that can help you get out of bed.
Right.
I mean, it's the simplest thing.
Yes.
Get out
of
bed,
yes.
Wash your clothes, and
brush your teeth.
And be a human.
I don't want to say that anybody who feels deep sense of unhappiness all the time is lesser than anyone else.
Mm. Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But we must move on from, well, I was going to say earlier, one extreme to the other, but it's not actually. It is now from happiness, where we ended up talking about misery more, to Bernice's topic, the Gothic.
The Gothic. So, what is Gothic? So, the word Gothic comes from the word Goth, who are Germanic people who came into conflict with the Romans during the early Christian era. So, it's a word that implies sinister, horror, you know, sacred architecture. It's got lots and lots of different meanings. But the word Gothic was coined during the Renaissance, and the Renaissance artists deemed it sort of barbaric because it was wild and gloomy and you know, it was all about the worthless darkness during the Middle Ages. And then the Protestant Reformation came along, so it was forgotten for about 300 years, and it was the Georgians who embraced it in the 19th century. So it was a revival of the Gothic architecture, that every man sees his house as a castle. It also affected literature, and there was a taste for, you know, the weirdness in art, the midnight moment of British history. So, you know, with the advent of the Industrial Revolution, science and technology, Frankenstein, Mary Shelley, so all these things sort of came to be. But it really looked at sort of the deepest desires and fears of mankind. The first Gothic novel was written by this guy called Horace Walpole, called The Castle of Otranto in 1764. And this was the first Gothic novel, which sort of, you know, gave life to hundreds and thousands of other Gothic novels. And it really was about this castle with an evil tyrant who's haunted by a knight. Not really a knight, but by a suit of armor, which kind of follows him around the castle. So this was like in 18th century. So the suit of armor defeats the tyrant, destroys the castle. But this was a fiction that gave sort of birth to all these other crazy imaginations.
But that also had an unhappy ending then.
Yes,
part of the Gothic thing is that you, as you're reading it, you do not expect a happy ending.
No, you know
so that it's going to be
a complete contrast of what we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
You know, and then Shakespeare, of course, came along, and you know, comedies became tragedies, and tragedies became comedies. But you know, it also looked at sort of the sense of the spiritual void. Now, the Gothic is very much entrenched in British history, because this looks at sort of the different ages that happened in Britain. Northanger Abbey, you know, with Jane Austen. So then, okay, in the 19th century, with the Industrial Revolution, it was kind of like the end of this old social order. You know, we had machines coming to being. Britain was transforming. And the Gothic became sort of like the horror of nightmares, which leads us to Victorian England. It was kind of like a, you know, collective crisis of identity. And Dickens wrote about it in Bleak House. It was like London became sort of like the monster within and without. So I'm looking very much in terms of literature as well. But it had to do with guilt and shame and all those terrible things.
Okay, well, can we just try and nail it down?
If you read Karl Marx, right? Okay. I mean, the evil, the demon, the monster is
the
capitalism.
The factory. Yeah.
The factory. Yeah. So capitalism. And now we are all living in the age of the Gothic. So what I'm trying to say is that this notion of the Gothic still persists. It is still here today. We are now slaves to capitalism and to industry. And this monster is still there. It will always be there.
I see where you're coming from. But like, you know, the internet and AI and the like. But somehow that has a different literal color. I mean, Gothic has black. Gothic was darkness. It was about you're in your room, the candlelight flickers, and you can see what's there. But outside the window is the horror of the monster. Whereas now we are so surrounded by light and electricity. Right. I wonder if we can call it Gothic.
If you remember, like, you know, Charlie Chaplin did a lot of movies with him trying to fight the machines and stuff, right? Like, I did not picture that as the Gothic. Like, I thought...
I wouldn't have either.
Yeah, I had no...
But Bernice, you do? You do,
yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, with this sort of new sort of definition, you know, with the Gothic, I think it's pervasive. It's in our everyday lives. Our phones are vampires, you know, all things read from Dracula. You know, the vampirical notion of society, always wanting this and wanting more. And right. then we're never happy. We're just not happy.
So it's like the Gothic celebrates the human nature's need to constantly seek out things to be afraid of, it sounds like.
Yes. But to also kind of unearth the very deepest desires of human beings, you know, shame and guilt. And things like that, you know, it's all part and parcel of who we are.
I guess the classic Gothic story is Frankenstein. You had a mad professor driven by rage and also by his own personal sense of loss to create a human out of the parts of out of many other humans.
Yes.
And so that in a way was looking at the pursuit of modern medicine, about modern science at that time. And Mary Shelley was saying, where will it all end? Before you know it, we'll be able to create monsters out of men.
Yes.
And that may seem at first like a good idea, but actually...
Well, it's
the horror, because she really concentrated on the monster and, like, how did he feel about all this?
I have a question. Yeah. So would you consider the Marvel Universe as Gothic? Because it's like you constantly seek out, you know, like constantly, you know, being afraid of, like, something else. And, of course, like, you always get it over... With so why would you call it Gothic if it's just like simply, you know, the nature of life, like you know, seeking out something to be afraid of? Like.
I think the DC universe is Gothic.
Okay,
Batman. No, Batman.
It's darker. It's a lot darker. But also it's the notion of who is consuming who. What are we consuming, and who is consuming us? What are we consumed by? You know, modern age makes vampires of us all. I mean, you know. It's you know, it's quite an extraordinary notion that from the medieval church, you know, flying buttresses and all that, to Frankenstein, to Dracula, to Das Kapital.
If you were to send a person in to one place to go and experience the full majesty and horror of Gothic, what would it be?
Well, I think Dracula is pretty good too. So yeah, it would be Frankenstein and
Dracula's had so many iterations. You can just like redo Dracula in so many ways.
Yeah. Do you have a book that you think?
No, but I have like multiple films. I felt like the Odessa Step Massacre Okay, so it's like
Sergei Eisenstein's Battleship Potemkin.
Battleship Potemkin feels gothic to me. I don't know if it is.
I see what you mean. Those close-up shots of sort of like people screaming and the agony.
And I love Battleship Potemkin.
The agony and the ecstasy.
It's ecstasy, yes. So that's essentially, yes.
So we must move on. What a happy beginning to this show so far. But in a moment, we're going to go to a completely different direction with a geology here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Karim Ruslan, Rahma Pauzi, and Bernice Chorley. And now, geology and culture. This is perhaps just an excuse for me to talk about geology and rocks, because I love geology, and I never do. So, our story begins, dear listener, 1,500 million years ago, when a gigantic magma chamber of volcanic rock formed about 10 miles below the ground. And over time, it moved upwards and it cooled down. And it raised above the surface of Earth, the mantle, and over time again, it wore down and rain made it smaller. And that is the spine of Peninsular Malaysia, the main range, the Titiwangsa range. Mm-hmm. And it's made of a rock called granite. And 50% of the rock in all of Malaysia, both east and west, is granite. When you have a big rock like that, that formed underground, it's made of granite, it's called a batholith. And that's just not me with a lisp. It's what it's called. Mount Kinabalu is also a batholith, just a gigantic rock. And that's an even harder rock than the main range rock. Slightly to the east, there's another batholith in Pahang. And that was actually volcanic, and that came 700 million years ago. And around volcanic plumes is where you get gold. So over to the east in Pahang, you have gold fields. But in the west, you have tin, because every batholith has its granite, has its own particular chemistry. Mm. And it just so happens that the chemistry here it includes a lot of tin. And so over time, that tin has washed out of the mountains into the floodplains where it has gathered. And but one of the things to think about with this rock is incredibly hard. It's impossible to fashion with stone tools. In fact, you use granite to hit other things to break them up. You really can't use early iron or bronze tools. It would just be blunted. And so we don't have any ancient palaces, ancient places of worship hidden away, because people couldn't make anything out of them. Meanwhile, you go to, say, Java, Borobudur. Borobudur is built from volcanic pumice. Mm. That's the ash that is blown out and then lands and is hardened, and it becomes a very easy to work stone. Mm-hmm. You just rub it together. If you go to Bali, it's the same thing. Volcanic pumice again, very easy to make beautiful structures. You go to Angkor Wat up in Cambodia. That's sandstone. Mm. And I happen to grow up, where I grew up in England was a very sandstone area, so I know how easy it is to fashion structures out of sandstone. Mm-hmm. But here, cannot. Mm. So I can guarantee 100% there is no city hidden, lost city, hidden in the jungles of Peninsular Malaysia. Because you simply couldn't make it. And I wonder if the lack of stone structures, we don't have a Stonehenge. We don't even have those Gothic cathedrals we've been talking about. Yeah. That lack of stone structures, the lack of permanence, the fact that if anybody did fashion anything, it would have been out of wood, which itself is dissolved.
Right.
That the tropics here, I mean, looking after a book is very difficult. Mm-hmm. So paper hasn't really been a part of, a terribly important part of culture here. I wonder if this makes an impact on culture, on the way that people think about culture, operate within culture, the expectations, and a sense of perhaps constant sense of newness. Every day's a new day.
Yeah.
Because it's not really being built necessarily on...
Because there's no way for them to build it.
Yeah.
No, I mean, if you know, I was recently just in Maxwell Hill over the weekend, and, you know, you have these massive boulders, like these huge rocks that just, like, you just look and you think, my God, that's a really big rock.
And of course,
you know, and
that's part of the Taiping Pluton. It's one of the sort of bubbles of magma that came out of the great magma chamber. It bubbled up in typing. But I thought you'd like to know that.
Oh, cool. Okay, yeah. Cool. But yeah, I mean, I do understand what you're saying, but we do have very hardwoods here. And I think if you look at cultures across the equator, you know, including the Amazon and the tribes that live around the equator all over the world, I suppose the notion of culture came from structures that we could construct out of wood.
Right.
You know, yeah. If you look at the Orang Asli in Semenanjung, yeah. Yes, they have structures that are built out of wood. They have carvings, ritualistic carvings. If you look at Borneo, they have their longhouses and their burial grounds and their totems as well. And if you look at Papua, they have the Asmat tribe, have their totems. So I think it was looking at different kinds of wood, which, you know, if you go to the Metropolitan Museum in New York, and these structures have been around for, well, I wouldn't say thousands of years, but definitely a few hundred years. So.
I have a question though, Cam, also following up on that. You remember the Lembah Bujang Chandi?
Yes. Mm.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So
yes.
How about that? What's that?
Yes. Well, he was
so that, brick. So the things that were made there were out of brick, which can be made here because it just requires clays, which were easily found in the ground, mm-hmm. and you fashion into bricks. But the technology for bricks came from India. Mm. People here, living here prior to that, had no need for bricks because you could just, whatever you wanted to make, you made it out of wood. Mm. There was no necessity. Whereas if you go to India, it might be that in drier parts of India, say, brick would have been a necessity because wood wasn't so available.
Right.
So technology grows where it is needed.
Yeah. Could it also be that, okay, now that thinking, you know, given the range, I bet we have a lot of caves, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So it could also be that people would see caves as like the big structure at that time, you know, like the where the population would concentrate at.
And recently there were some paintings that were found in Borneo that have been deemed older than the paintings found in France.
Right. And also in Ipoh. You're an Ipoh girl.
Yes. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And Ipoh, there are Neolithic
exactly where the Perak man was
at. Yes. Yeah. Perak man that's above Kualakangsa. I went there recently, and that was cave life. That's very ancient. The exact numbers I can't remember now. At least 10,000 years. And that was because a rock fall had happened even before that and had dammed up this valley. So this very large lake was built, happened there. And there were caves, etc. So it was just a really wonderful place to live. Mm. Fish in the lake, you had wildlife, trees, etc. The living was easy.
So I suppose you could look at it as a sort of a natural, you know, these are natural formations and they didn't have to build anything because they could live within within the hollows of these structures.
Exactly. Mm. And one important and one vitally important feature of Malay life, which then confuses me how the memory of it seems to have died so quickly, so very quickly, is the river. Because everybody lived on the river.
Yeah.
I mean, it just made sense. I mean, you don't live in the middle of the jungle. What the hell would you do that for? You live in the river because the transportation's easy, the connections to other places, trade comes to you or you can go to it, food is there in abundance. And yet now we poison our rivers and with the greatest of ease. Mm-hmm. We cover them over. It doesn't seem to bother us. I find it so strange that we've turned our backs on our rivers so easily.
If you read Isabella Bird's The Golden Kersanese, it's all about rivers. It's just, you know, how they traveled into the interior and you know, the old communities that were built by the river. So the Orang Sungai, you know, the notion of, it's sad because so many communities around the world, you know,
and also to
flourished
think,
around rivers.
Yeah, and to think that there's so many places in Malaysia that was named Kuala, which essentially means, you know, like it's the meeting point of two rivers. Mm. And, you know, the fact that so many places in Malaysia, you know, comes with Kuala something that, you know, that always shows like how.
Yeah, there are a few townships you can think of that don't have that relationship. I mean, like, you know, Putrajaya, Genting.
Well, Genting's built on a big rock.
Yeah, and also Putrajaya. I mean, that's not real city. I'm sorry.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Cyberjaya. So anyway, that was just an excuse for me to talk about geology. But I think that it is a way of looking at culture and the landscape in which it is to see how there's a relationship and one determines the other.
Yeah.
I mean, we have not had a Michelangelo here because we don't have the marble.
Yeah.
Well, actually, you're doing it in Langkawi.
We do have the marble, but it's just, you know.
Geologically, we must move. But I just want to say, geologically, Langkawi is a fascinating place. It is the one place in this country where it's a very small area, mm-hmm. but all these different rock types can be found, from very, very ancient rocks, mm. where you have fossils, etc., to quite young rocks. You can have coal and everything. It's all compressed into one little spot in Langkawi. Fascinating spot.
Mm. But allow me to just say one more thing. And I thought that is really interesting because it allows us to use a lot more empathetic language whenever we, not accuse, but or like we try to start condemning. Like, why do we not have this? Why, or like it almost feels like, you know, the moment we try to make people appreciate culture or make something out of something on the place that they live because that's what's being done in Europe, for example, is you're forcing something that's essentially not within that person, the community's DNA.
I agree entirely. Why can't you go off and do, paint the Last Supper? Well,
why do we not have castles, for example?
We
have wooden castles, which are quite beautiful.
Do we?
Yes.
There are a few. Sri Menanti.
Yeah, and the one in Kuala Kangsa is built out of wood as well. It's very beautiful.
Is it castle? Anyway, okay.
What's Istana.
Okay, yeah, sorry. So anyway, we must move on to the final part of the show. Recommendations, where we recommend something that we think might be of interest. And Rahma goes first.
Okay, so I don't know why I'm obsessed about the notion of happiness lately, which is fair, I guess. But this is one video that I used to watch back then. It's 2013, by this one filmmaker. I don't remember her last name, but her first name is Bianca. But you can look up this one short film. It's called The Scared Is Scared. And it's really sweet because it's about this one young filmmaker interviewing her niece, nephew, actually, about, just give me a story. I'm going to make a film out of it. And then she, followed the story about what do you do when you're scared of something. And then he said something that's really wonderful, and I thought, and I would share with everyone. He said, "The scared is scared of all the things that you like. So whenever that you're scared, you think of something that you like." And he said, "I would think of cookies whenever, before he would go to sleep. He would say, I would think of cookies that shape in piano. I would think of swimming pools." And it was really cute, and it's I think it's there's wisdom in there because the filmmaker was graduating and she was scared of everything. Because she didn't know whether or not she was going to get a job and all that. But she had to keep thinking about things that drove her, right? Things that she was passionate about. Why, basically, the meaning as to, why is she doing film, or majoring in film to begin with. Mm. And I thought that was really nice. The scared is scared of all the things that you like. So for you to, let the scare go away, you think of things that you like because it will go away because it's scared of the things that you like.
All right. Okay, cool.
So it's called The Scared is Scared. You can look it up on Vimeo.
Have you watched The Sound of Music, by any chance?
I have, long time ago.
Raindrops on Roses and...
These are a few of my favorite
things. Okay, so that's... the movie again, sorry?
The Scared is Scared.
Okay.
The Scared is Scared.
Yes.
Okay, all right. Hmm. So, Bernice, what's yours?
Yo, okay, so I've just finished watching this incredibly... Wow, it's just breathtaking. 6-part episode called The Little Drummer Girl. Based on the Jean Le Carré's novel.
Yeah.
It stars Michael Shannon, Alexander Skarsgård, who is, just
Bit dreamy. Bit dreamy, is he?
Florence Pugh, who is a very young British actor, but it's directed by one of the greatest filmmakers of our time. Park Chan-wook. Korean filmmaker.
I have probably seen many of his films.
Yeah, Old Boy, Vengeance Trilogy.
Right.
It's just it is so beautifully shot. I can't even begin to. The music is superb, but you have this sort of, series that's set during the Cold War. So you've got Palestinian and Jewish intrigue going on. This actress becomes a spy for both, but it's shot by this Korean filmmaker, and it's just exquisite. It's one of the best things I've seen in a very, very, very long time.
Wow. I got goosebumps just listening to you.
I finished the last episode and I promptly went back to episode one and started watching it all over again. It's just amazing. It's absolutely amazing.
That's The Little Drummer Girl.
The Little Drummer Girl.
Which is a BBC production?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. Yes, yes.
Which has been on air. It just finished. This is brand new.
Yeah, no, I think it just ended about 2 weeks ago. No, it's superb. It's absolutely superb.
Are you a John le Carré?
Well, I've seen The Night Manager, you know, but this is it's just a thousand times better than The Night Manager. It's very, very good.
Oh, really?
It's very good. Costumes are brilliant. But Park Chan-wook, my God, it's like, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
Korean film is, I mean, I love Korean.
Yeah.
It's like a new thing that I like now.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I really like about Korean movies is the art direction.
Mm. Absolutely. And that's why this it's exquisite. Mm. I mean, to the cars, to the jewelry, to the clothes, the makeup, like, my God. And all the, you know, all the equipment that was, you know, they had during the 70s.
The attention to detail.
The attention to detail. Korean movies is really, it's, really good. I mean, he directed Fingersmith as well. You know, it's sort of made into a Korean setting, which is this English novel. But yeah, it's very, very good.
Okay,
it's just, and the music is just,
all right,
goodness.
I'm excited. I'm going to check it out.
The Little Drummer Girl.
All right. Okay, yes. Cool. From John le Carré. Mm-hmm. So my recommendation is, it's a bunch of videos on YouTube done by PBS, Public Broadcasting Service in America. And it's called PBS Eons. As in eons of time, from the Greek for a hell of a lot of time, E-O-N-S. And it's a bunch of videos, about 10 minutes long, where somebody will talk about life forms from millions of years ago. I mean, we're going way, way back. So you've got an episode where it talks about that time that it rained for 200 million years. It did. And or the time that the seas were filled with giant amphibians.
Mm.
Or one on how come the T-Rex lost but also maintained its little arms.
Mm.
And talking about different animals from the past, bone-crushing dogs, whatever happened to them. From
bone-crushing dogs?
Yes, there's a type of dog that lived in North America. And this is, the dates, you always get confused with the dates after a while, but it's a very long time ago. And they were so huge, and the power of their jaws was so great that it would just, like, crush bones and, like rip a camel's head off in one shot.
God.
Camels came
No camels in North America, though.
Not anymore, but they came from North America. Yes, they did.
What?
They
camels came from North America?
They evolved in North America and then moved across the Bering
Strait.
Well, it is now a sea gap, it used to be a land bridge. Mm. They moved across from there and then they died out in North America, but they actually originally evolved in North America.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's new.
Hmm.
And then there were horses in North America, which then became extinct. Mm-hmm. And then so when the Spanish...
Reintroduced
the horse. Yeah. They were actually like taking horses back.
Mm.
So these camels and horses were being attacked by these gigantic dogs, like 10 meters long, which is a big dog.
That doesn't sound like a pet.
No. It would keep you as a pet.
So these are sort of mini documentaries?
Little 10-minute things. One person talks. Cute. And what I really like about these kinds of things, it's just like really to the point. I mean, it's entertaining. It's funny. But it's just like a person just tells you something.
Yeah.
There's no kind of like going off like visuals going, ooh, and anything like that. The visuals are beautiful illustrations as well. But it's PBS Eons, and it talks about... the Permian, the Triassic, the Ordovician, the Devonian, it's fantastic. So check them out. I love it. I even use them to help me go to sleep, which is not a bad thing. I love
think happy thoughts. That makes you
makes me very happy.
Makes you very happy.
So I find it
great. 10 meter long.
Yeah. So we're able to end on a happy note, and only remains for me now to thank special on guest Bernice Chorley.
Thank you.
And Rahma Pauzi.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, pleasure. And myself, Cam Ruslan. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.